the Simply Focus with Elfie Czerny and Dominic Gilda for life and joy and ease.
Welcome back to the Simply Focus podcast, your podcast for life and joy and ease. This is episode number 29, and we're so happy to be here with Dwora Simon. My name is Dominic Gilda.
And I'm Elfie Czerny. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Dwora. It's so great to have you here on Zoom today. We visited you in New Mexico in Albuquerque, and we really enjoyed spending time with you.
I enjoyed you and your child and your bus, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, you even introduced us to some of your wonderful colleagues in New Mexico. Yeah,
to my co-partners in the program that I work in, and they were absolutely delighted to have that lovely dinner with you.
Oh, that was totally likewise, so thank you very much for making that possible.
Yeah.
Dwora, you're a clinical psychologist. You work with people labeled with mental illnesses. You're a solution focused practitioner for many, many years, worked with homeless people, and right now work as a psychologist with veterans in New Mexico.
That's right.
And you're, well, as I said, on your way with solution focus for many, many years. So, Dwora, what fascinates you with solution focus?
Well, unfortunately, because it's still needed. So when I first came across solution focus, it was something I had been looking for. I was being trained in a very pathology-focused model. I was trained in New York, and it was very dominated by a psychodynamic and very medical model at the time. And I had read Carl Rogers, and one of the things that fascinated me about Carl Rogers was that he had a practice of not reading the medical chart before meeting with somebody. He wanted to just have an authentic, in-the-moment meeting with that person. And I thought, well, that's really great. That's something I'm interested in, because he came to the person fresh and open to whatever could happen. But when I read about Carl Rogers, I didn't feel like his way of working was my way of working. I loved his assumptions, but it wasn't quite the right, you know, like you can be an artist, but one person is a sculptor and another is a painter and so on. And his means of doing his art wasn't quite mine. And so when I first attended a talk by Steve, and this was sometime in the late 80s, it was immediate. It was like, oh my God, that's what I've been looking for. This is a way of working that represents the values that I'm interested in. And from a spiritual point of view, I was interested in this idea that every moment is a moment of creation. Mm. And sort of the constructivist philosophical view that came from my Jewish mystical perspective that the world is created with a word. Right, that God speaks the world into being, and that we can do the same, and that the words we use and the words we don't use have so much impact. So I finally found somebody describing, here's how you ask a question, and here's what things you pay attention to, and here's what things you don't pay attention to, that was the closest to this sense of the potency of creation in the moment of meeting somebody with your silence and your listening and your presence and your words and your attention, so that both of you are invited into the space of possibility that never existed before. And when I say, unfortunately, it's still needed, is, you know, I thought the revolution would have happened by now. And to a certain extent, it has. You know, the positive psychology movement adopts certain things from solution focus, and motivational interviewing does, and certain aspects of cognitive behavior therapy do. So I think that, you know, whether it came directly from solution focus thinking, or, you know, there's an evolving zeitgeist that people don't always want to analyze the problem, but would rather be looking forward to what kind of life do I want to be living. So to a certain extent, I feel like solution-focused therapy as a thing is less necessary than it used to be. And, you know, in a way, I can relax about that. You know, I don't have to be like promoting it everywhere, because I think people are getting it, or getting aspects of what it was about it that's so, you know, I was so passionate about at the start. You know, at the time, I was vilified almost. I was working in a clinic in New York, and people would, you know, scream at me that I was missing the pathology. I was in denial of the pathology. And, you know, I was like, okay. The funny thing was, they would yell at me in the break room, or while the therapist would take a break. And then when they left the clinic, they would refer their patients to me. So I'm not exactly sure what that said. You know, so it was a very intense juxtaposition when I first started to do solution-focused therapy. And Ericksonian therapy also, which to me was in the same camp of being curious about possibilities and curious about resources and curious about, you know, utilization principle. And, you know, there's something something that's being labeled as a problem in this person's life. And what about that is also a resource and a path to something wonderful. So that was a very hard juxtaposition to what was happening at the time. In a way, it's less clear now with, you know, all these other schools of thought that are not so pathology focused. But I also feel like solution focus is a tradition now that the founders are gone. It's a tradition that continue to evolve and continue to represent in a very pure way. I hesitate to say, but faith that no matter where somebody is and what they're struggling with and what they're complaining about, there's a beautiful life that's possible for them. I hope that answered your question.
It just makes my heart sing listening to you. And you mentioned the part where you said spirituality. So from a spiritual point of view, solution focus spoke to you.
It did. I wrote a chapter at one point about solution focused therapy as a spiritual path. And I remember trying to engage Steve in that conversation. And he was personally very supportive. But what he said to me was it was not his language. So it's the lens through which I came to solution focus and still hold it. And I also don't feel like it's necessary to have that lens to do solution focused therapy. But that's my lens. And it wasn't particularly his. I felt like he was doing something very incredible. He and Insu and Eve Lipchick and, you know, the people that were there at the time were doing just miraculous work. It was so tender and beautiful, and that we all have different ways of describing what it was. But that was my language for it.
Oh, yeah. And I remember when you told us this story in New Mexico, when Dominic said, oh, that's good. I have to remember that. That's not my language, because I'm very often talking in this language to Dominic.
Yeah, it's true. You know, that reminds me, it's not quite the same, but it reminds me, do you know the poem Naomi Shahib Nye?
Not yet.
She's a poet with a Palestinian father and her mother, I don't remember from which country, European mother, and then grew up in America. And she has the most magnificent poetry and beautiful things. I just encourage everybody to go read her poetry. But she says that her father, you know, Palestinian, would, when people were trying to argue with him, you know, like about the Middle East or whatever, that he never became negative with them. He would say, my friend, you're missing some information. And it's such a lovely way to disagree with somebody. You know, I'm afraid you're missing some information. Like, or that isn't my language. It seems like a similar way to hold the possibility of difference without it becoming an enmity.
And that's the great thing about our podcast and all the people who have already been on there. There's so many ways of how to describe solution focus, and every perspective has its beauty and its advantages. And we learned so much about different views here with this podcast.
Yeah, that's lovely. And you know, it always should be a conversation. It's never one thing.
So true.
Yeah. And I'll say that in those early days, you know, because Steve and Insu and Eve Lipchick would come to New York. Insu's daughter was living in New York at the time. So they would come once a month and do a workshop. And they did this for about 2 years. And, you know, it was one or the other or different combinations of them. And it was held in a place on 14th Street, literally the meat market. I mean, you had to walk by hanging carcasses to get to this space. It was crazy. It was also called the meat market because there were prostitutes. And then you get up into this room. It was a family therapy space with a one-way mirror. And we would bring our clients and do all these different things. And it was always evolving. It's like they would come back because their client had taught them something new. And then there was the miracle question. You know, first it was an emphasis on exceptions to the problem pattern. And then there was the miracle question. And it was always evolving. So I think as a movement or an entity, the solution focused world has an interesting challenge, which all movements have, which is when you make it a thing, when you name it, how much do you adhere to the older forms and how much do you continue to let it evolve and change without losing what it is, without losing the essence of what it is? Mm. So, you know, I think there's room for all the versions, because I call myself a solution-focused therapist because it's the core of how I think about everything. But I don't necessarily always do a session with all the sequences and the break and the homework and the this and the that. That's the way I originally learned, you know, what solution-focused therapy is, because I'm always, you know, meeting a new individual and trying to do my best to be with them with what's going to work for them. But, you know, I think there's room for the purists, and I think there's room for the integrators, and there's room for all of us as long as we can continue to stay in conversation with each other and, you know, keep talking about what's the core, what's the essence that will always make it solution focused even when the form might be changing.
So what are some of the things that have evolved in your practice? They say, well, now I'm doing it like this, and back then I used to do it like that.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with context and culture. So asking the questions will sound different with a person of coming from military culture, a person who has many years of relationship to psychotherapy and expectations about what it looks like, or a person who has, Hispanic culture, like many people where I work do, or Native American culture. So I think the essence is the same, that I am interested in what's possible, and I'm interested in supporting a conversation for that person about what is possible for them and what they're wanting. Yeah, I'm not sure I can come up with a specific example, but it's not always going to look like the miracle question. It might look like, when we meet again in a month, what will be different? What would you be delighted to have happening in your life? Right. I'll tell you a little story about the place I work. I work in New Mexico, and there's a lot of Native American people here. And the first time I worked with somebody, and at the time I was working in a residential program for people with alcohol abuse and drug abuse, and he had only been there a little while, and he wanted to leave. And he knew, and I knew, that he wasn't ready to leave. He wasn't sort of clear enough in his sobriety. But he said, but I have to go, because I have to go back to the reservation, because I have to chop wood for the winter, or my family will be cold. And, it's such a humbling thing to realize I have no idea what's going on. And to accept that, it was like, oh, of course, you have to take care of your family. And I don't know what became of him. I don't know how he was with his drinking later. So there's a lot more of not knowing. The other story I think about, and this is not solution focused, but it's Ericksonian. Early on in my training, me and two other students had some time with one of the Ericksonian teachers. And he told us a story about a woman who came to him because she wanted to stop smoking. And he was using all his fancy Ericksonian, indirect metaphoric inductions. And she was getting more and more frustrated and irritated. She wasn't going into trance. And he said, well, what's going on? And she said, well, 20 years ago, I went to somebody, to a hypnotist, and he just told me to stop smoking. He went, why can't you do that? And, I take this as a lesson, that not to put my method ahead of what's going to actually work for the client. So, we like to be very collaborative and solution focused, but sometimes somebody wants me to be directive. It's that kind of choice. It's that kind of nuance. So am I making an icon or an idol of something that I think is very valuable at the expense of the living process of what's happening?
So, and Dvorah, what helps you to notice that this person needs more of a direction or a directive, maybe word, and that another person needs maybe more, an invitation to talk and just explore it for him or herself.
You never lose when you ask, when you say the preference. Like, I remember Jay Haley saying this, but he was doing it in a sort of tricky way. He was saying, would you like to go into trance now or in 5 minutes, which was an Ericksonian thing, or would you like to do the therapy knowing what I'm up to or not knowing, right? But I just take that at face value and say something like, would you like us to try to figure this out together? Would you like me to give you some suggestions? I don't like to give advice, but I actually have some advice for you. Are you interested? Would that be helpful? So I try to intuit the preference and then offer it as a choice. And sometimes people tell me one way, sometimes they say the other. So I hope I'm not loading the deck, that it's a genuine choice. How would you like to do this? There's another example of that, which is where I work. There's a lot of wired paperwork and questionnaires and, psychological tests and so on that we have to give. And we're supposed to give it in the first session before we do anything therapeutic. And I hate that. I don't like that to be the way that I meet somebody. So I'll give them a choice. I'll say, there's a bunch of paperwork we're supposed to do. We have two ways we can do this. We can just get to know each other today, and we'll do that next week. Or if you like, we can do it today and get it out of the way, and then we'll get to know each other. And sometimes people pick one way, sometimes the other.
I like the idea of offering your thoughts as an invitation to choose. And I think this also makes visible how much choice we have.
Right. Now, I'll say that there are times where I will become more directive if somebody seems to be getting more and more anxious with too much choice than just saying, this is what we're doing today, right? This is what we're doing right now. Take a deep breath, that kind of thing, to give an instruction. And in working with military populations, that's sometimes kind of built into the culture of wanting direction. Mm-hmm. Not always. I mean, what did Steve used to say? Never do anything always, So these are examples, but not directives right now. These these are not prescriptions, but examples of the ways that it can sometimes go.
So Dora, when you worked with homeless people, what difference did solution focus make there? And can you tell a little bit more about this work you did there?
Yeah, I'm going to sideline a little bit before I answer that, which is that when I was hired from my current position, somebody asked me how I felt about working with people with, you know, what they call serious mental illness, like schizophrenia, people that hear voices, psychotic disorders of various kinds. And I quoted Insoo. I said, well, as Insoo Berg says, don't be too impressed by the pathology. Mm. And then the other thing I said was people are people. So you say homeless people, and in my mind, I immediately want to say people who don't have housing, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes we're going to say the shortcut, homeless population. But first, they're people. And realizing, you know, there's various programs out there to get them housed in this way or that way, and to always be sure to ask the person's preference. You know, there were some people that said, I don't want housing. There were some Vietnam veterans in particular that were more comfortable camping in the woods. Not often, this is not common, but more than twice I came across this. And so trying to force somebody into a housing program who doesn't want to be there, that's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I also used to do a thing of, you know, Yvonne Dolan in some of her books, she talks about writing a letter to yourself. So she talks about on a good day, writing a letter to yourself to read on a bad day, or projecting 6 months in the future and writing a letter to yourself now. I did that a lot when I was in a residential program with people that were homeless. And then also just imagining the place you're going to live and what color are the walls and what's outside the window and what kind of art or furniture and what kind of music is playing. So we did some of that future projecting, because sometimes asking people, what is your preference? They didn't know. And sometimes they just were not in the habit of having a preference because life hadn't given them a lot of options for a long time. Or they might have a belief that they don't get to have a preference, or, you know, they screwed their life up so much they don't deserve a preference. So I did a lot of that with just imagining, I would say, a pretty good future. It doesn't have to be the 10 of the miracle, but it's pretty good. It's a pretty good day and your life is pretty good. What's happening? Because that somehow seemed more facilitative of the imaginal process than of saying that it was great. But it was pretty good. It was all right. It was pretty good. It wasn't terrible, you know?
Yeah, just the other day we heard the story about people having really bad days and then imagining only a bad day, another really bad day as kind of part of their preferred future.
Yeah, just a regular bad day instead of a terrible bad day.
Yeah
exactly.
Yeah.
Kind of a good bad day.
Right.
And what would you notice there and how would that look like? And
just ordinary crappiness.
Yeah.
You know, that goes back to Freud. Freud said that the goal of psychoanalysis was to turn neurotic suffering into ordinary unhappiness. That's great.
So Dora, in the program you're working right now, what do you particularly like about the work you do and how do you use solution focus there?
I don't know that I can give you like one answer to that. I really feel like it's one person at a time. And so, you know, when I think about the population I'm working with now, it's not different from my whole career. It's always one person at a time. It's always that sense of, you know, I'm so curious to discover who this person is and what they're up to. And, you know, one of my other influences is the Ericksonian work as I've learned it through Stephen Gilligan. And this is something he used to say at his workshops, is that he starts a session with somebody with the assumption that they're up to something big and that he's really curious to discover what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. So I love that as going into the attitude. And there was another psychologist I knew, he didn't describe himself in any of these terms, but he gave some training at my psychology internship. And he said something that just so resonated for me. He said, and you know, you can remove the God language. It's not essential that it has God language, but in this instance it did. He said, I assume that every person that comes into my office was sent by God to teach me something. So I'm just open to whatever that's going to be.
That is so beautiful. Yeah. Highlighting. It's
yeah,
not.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can say sent by the universe or just this person arrived in my life for a reason. And you don't have to believe that in an essentialist way, but I find as a construction, it's a useful construction for me. Mm-hmm. You know, like what's going on here? What is the fantastic opportunity that I have been given and honored to have in working with this particular person? The other thing I wanted to say is that, and this is something I just came back from a Stephen Gilligan workshop, and something that I don't know that I quite have the words for yet, but it has to do with loving the parts that don't work. to love your failures and to love the times, you know, that I was talking a few minutes ago about, you know, being curious and grateful and, you know, just this sort of loving, open-hearted way to be with everybody. And of course, that's the ideal. And I also know that I'm not going to fulfill that ideal every day. And there's going to be days when I'm tense or irritated or, you know, I wish the client would be more cooperative and get better already or whatever it is. And that rather than fighting that, that embracing and expanding the awareness to let that be there as another part of the conversation. So that's another thing that I'm working with. I find that, you know, there's a parallel process that the more accepting I am of myself with all my flaws, I hope that's being communicated in terms of what the client feels as well, that they get to be successful and they also get to not be successful. They get to have a good day and also a bad day, and that they're not failing the therapy, right, if they had a crappy week. It's just another piece of information. And that sometimes if I'm, you know, stressed or irritated and, you know, not at my ideal solution-focused self, that's another piece of information too. And that I can, you know, be curious about that.
That reminds me of the podcast we did with Bill O'Hanlon, and he sang about having those two things kind of working and not working at the same time.
That's great.
And accepting
that. That's great. Well, of course, he's coming straight from an Ericksonian model as well.
So, Dvar, you in your team, you also invite solution-focused conversations. So how does, when you work with your colleagues, solution-focused make a difference for you and your colleagues?
I think as a team, we work very well together, and I try to embody the principles as a supervisor and as a trainer of valuing what each person in the team has to bring, that they have different interests. For example, one of them that you met has an interest in music therapy. And so I might think, well, that's not really what we do in a program, except that she brings so much aliveness when she's doing that, that I will support that, right? So I'll support what people are passionate about because they're bringing their best self. You know, when people are happy in what they're doing and they get to express what they're most passionate about, then the quality of the work will always be better.
Oh, and this colleague shared such a beautiful story of how she wrote a song with her participants.
That's right. They wrote a song. Yes, exactly. And won an award for it also.
Yes, so it's just beautiful what arises out of that, that not only makes a difference for the trainer, but also for every single participant, I guess, and where they created something where they could be proud of and something they could show, actually. There was this concert afterwards.
I think they won second place nationally for an arts festival. I don't remember exactly the details, but yes, it was a very successful endeavor. And it started with, you know, this is something I love. So I think that coworkers need to be in what they love as well as clients.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't want to be the person who enforces solution focus. You know? You know, and is critical about solution focus. You're not being solution focused, you know. That seems like a complete contradiction to the model. I'd rather be really curious about where they are being successful with their clients. You know, what's working? What's working at all the levels of the system? And how do we support that? Even if, you know, if a person says, I did cognitive behavior therapy and it really worked with this client, I'm not going to say that wasn't solution focused. I'm going to say, fantastic. Tell us more. Tell us more about how it worked and how you approached it and what made it work with that client. So, you know, I don't know that everybody would agree with me on that, but I try to keep the spirit in approaching all the levels of the system.
And it seems your colleagues truly appreciate that. I mean, as far as we can say that from our conversations we had...
We had a lot of
team members. So.
Yes, and the other team member was so enamored of you traveling around in a van because she has this dream to follow her favorite band around the country. I had never seen her so like lit up about that kind of thing. I was like, oh, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, all right. Now I know something more. Yeah.
And maybe she's doing therapy in her van and taking your clients there.
Maybe she is. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I love what you say about really seeing them as experts for their life and for the job they have, yes. and really fostering their passion and their love, like we do with clients, fostering what they want. And,
And as a result, you know, when I introduce solution-focused ideas, we have like a case conference, whatever, and I suggest a way to ask a question, they're open, you know, everybody's open to trying new things. Mm-hmm. Because when people feel respected, they're going to be, you know, happy to try something new. And I do genuinely respect them, and I have things to learn from them. You know, they have different backgrounds and so on. So it's better all around.
So Dvara, you're not only a passionate solution-focused practitioner, you're also an author and write poetry, and you wrote this lovely, beautiful book, Mercy.
Thank you.
Where there are a lot of poems. I have it close to myself and love to read from time to time in it. And I also read, we didn't actually talk about that when we met, that you give poetry workshops.
I have in the past. I haven't done one lately, but recently somebody was asking about it, so it might happen again soon.
Would love to hear more about that, whether it also solution focus makes a difference there, or how you...
Well,
I guess it does, because you are solution focused. Right.
and I'm going to say Ericksonian too. You know, there's obviously a strong familial relationship between Ericksonian work, Ericksonian hypnosis, and solution focus, and some people will identify more that one with the other, but that's a very strong part of the poetry workshop in particular. So I can tell you how I structure it. It's called Words Rise Up from Silence. And the premise of the workshop, which I used to do as a one-day workshop, the premise of the workshop is that there is a spectrum of speech. As I talk about this, I'm actually slowing down in my speech because I want to illustrate what I'm talking about, which is there's speech that's reporting, you know, this sort of reciting a narrative that may be somewhat familiar that you've said before, or you've thought about before, or even if it's a new string of words, it's reporting on an experience rather than being a direct expression of that experience. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's how we mostly talk. But that poetry, and I would say good therapy also, because I gave this workshop for therapists, is a way of using language that directly comes right out of the experience. And I'm not a linguist and I'm not a philosopher of language, so I'm not making a claim about this in terms of any kind of absolute sense or essentialist sense of what language is. But speaking as poet in a poetic way, when there is a sense of the body and of the feelings in the body, of the sense of the room, sense of energy, and a sense of the silence, and then of the word arising right out of that experience, that's poetry.
So
words rise up from silence. So I start the day with an Ericksonian trance, a guided imagery process. And the first half of the day is about receiving, and the second half of the day is about expressing. So I believe that poetry is a natural process and that it's a matter of permissions. So the first permission is to listen. And the guided imagery has to do with arriving in a journey, you know, to a sacred place, and meeting a figure, whether it's a, you know, a shamanic being, an animal, a tree, a priest or a priestess, and receiving a message from that being and just allowing it to wash over you without critique, without editing, and then, you know, taking notes of words that came out of that. And then the second half of the day is about going back to that place and then being that wise person with a message and stepping into the role of having the right to express. And from that, you know, along with some other writing techniques, arriving at poetry. So the permission to listen and the permission to express, that's that workshop in a nutshell.
I love the idea of the permission to listen, the permission to express, and then really connect with the wise part or allow us to show our voice, to express our voice and share that with others.
Yeah, that's right.
And it connects very well to what you said before with letting it emerge out of the moment and being there and kind of listening and then expressing instead of kind of having a formula of doing it like this, this, and this.
Right. You know, one of the most distinctive ways of watching Steve DeShazer, was the silences. Mm. There was a lot of silence, but it was not ever empty.
Yeah.
Wow. So, solution-focused journey for many, many years. What would you say could be one takeaway for practitioners out there? You say, well, I would like to give that to them.
I would say that it has to be meaningful to that person. The way a lot of therapists are being trained these days has to do with learning a technique or learning a protocol. And I'm not against these protocols. Sometimes they're just absolutely the best thing for somebody. I work in a place where evidence-based protocols for trauma treatment, for example, and, you know, it's a 12-session protocol and the person goes through it and it's pretty unvarying and it works. So I'm not saying those things don't work. I'm saying that for me, there's another realm that's possible. Like, who are the people that invent protocols, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody has to be connecting with that person, with that client. They have to be connecting with their own intuition. They have to be open and flexible and curious and taking note and paying attention, and that it's from that quality of work that the new protocols arise and the new methods arise, the new question arrives, you know, the best hopes question, you know, whatever it is. So I would like to see, I'm hesitating because I don't think you can formalize this. I don't think you can develop a protocol to work without a protocol. You can't say you must train, you know, therapists in this way of not being tied to a protocol, and that becomes your new protocol. So I believe in a live transmission, and the live transmission has both to do with your teachers and being willing to be taught and using examples, and of course being willing to be taught by your clients and be willing to be taught by yourself, by your own experience. So I guess the shorthand for that is stay alive. I have a book about haiku, and I came across this book many years ago in a used bookstore in New York, and it's still around in my place somewhere. And in the introduction to this book of beautiful haikus is the statement that the writer of the haiku assumes that the reader is alive. Because the haiku has so few words. It can't explain everything. It relies on the listener, the reader, to bring themselves to it. So in a way, I could say solution-focused therapy is the haiku of the therapy world. And it relies on us to bring ourselves to it.
Wow. It's just poetry to listen to you, Dora.
Well, you got me started. What can I say? And, you know, just like I knew that I couldn't be Carl Rogers, I also knew I couldn't be Steve DeShazer or Inse Berg or Eve Lipchick. You know, like, these were my teachers, and I had so much respect for them. And Eve, thankfully, is still alive. I have so much respect for them. I learned so much from all of them. I learned from Eve about that the client comes to the therapy in an either-or position, and that our job is to hold the both and. Right? I remember her saying that one time at a conference, and just really, you know, like, I was so hungry for what all of these guys had to say and for watching them work and everything. But I knew I have my own being. I have my own personality. I have my own way of working. I was never going to be able to use as few words as Steve. I was never going to be convincing and authentic in saying, wow, the way Insu was. You know, it was always going to be something different, and that was okay. It was important to be myself in embracing this way of working and to filter it and to express it in the way that I do it. And that's true for everybody. You know, everybody has to be themselves. It's not about copying anything.
And I also think this makes us feel alive at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So for all the life people out there, what's your challenge of the week that you will give them?
The challenge of the week is to listen for a mistake that you make and love it.
I'm in.
and just say, oh, thank you. What a lovely mistake. And then to see what happens next.
Wow.
I want to say I was inspired by when you asked me earlier to think of a challenge for the week. What came right into my head was the David Bowie song, Loving the Alien. Believing the strangest things, loving the alien. So love your alien. Love your mistakes.
Love your flaws.
Love your flaws. Yes, genuinely.
Thank you very much, dear Dvora, for this very inspiring conversation. And thank you, everyone, for listening. If you like what we said, if you're inspired by our conversation, please let us know and share it in the comments field of our podcast on www.sfmcure.com/simplyfocuspodcast. Because as usually, I would love to remind you that what inspires you might make a huge and valuable difference for someone else and might even help going someone on his or her solution-focused journey.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, thank you, dear Dvora. And if you have not yet done, please subscribe to our podcast on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Blueberry, or other platforms.
And you will also find the resources we mentioned in the podcast, like, for instance, Borah's book, Mercy, in the resource section of the podcast.
Or the work of Stephen Gilligan and others. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much, Borah, for talking to us, to being here.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
And please give a big hug to your colleagues.
I will. And I'll give them the link so we can all be part of it.
Yeah. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Bye.